You're listening to the best of the day.
I say you and you the best.
Halford and Bruff.
On a Tuesday, Big Band Tuesday here on the Halford and Bruff Show. Halford and Bruff of the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Three dealerships to serve you better. North Shore Acura, Acura of Langley, and Burrard Acura on Terminal Avenue. 7 o'clock hour on the Halford and Bruff Show is going to feature former teammate of Daniel and Henrik Sedin and Roberto Luongo, Mikhail Samuelson. He'll be joining us in just a moment here. At 7:30, more Hall of Fame talk with Sean McIndoe, better known as Down Goes Brown from The Athletic. But let's get to the topic at hand. Three former Canucks yesterday, first ballot Hall of Famers, Henrik Sedin, Daniel Sedin, and Roberto Luongo. One of their former teammates here in Vancouver joins us now on the Halford and Bruff Show. It is Mikhail Samuelson here on Sportsnet 650. Good morning, Mikhail. How are you?
Thanks. How are you guys? It's not morning for me here in Sweden, but
that's right. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon there, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay. We want to get into maybe just your reaction first and foremost when you found out that two of your former teammates in Daniel and Henrik Sedin and your fellow countrymen were going to the Hall of Fame, but not just them. From that group that played together in Vancouver, a third first ballot Hall of Famer in Roberto Luongo also gets the call to the Hall. So when you're sitting back at home in Sweden and you get the news, what was your initial reaction to all three going into their first shot at going to the Hall of Fame?
About time. No, I'm just kidding. I was so happy for them. Like, really, really happy. And it made me proud, too, to just to say I was their teammate. So, well-deserved. Great people, all three of them. And, nothing but respect to the way they treated teammates and carry themselves. So good for them to see. I'm happy for them.
How did they treat teammates?
Say it again? How did they treat me?
How did they treat teammates?
Oh, they treated with, first of all, respect. They were very humble, all three. They made you very welcomed. They stayed humble. It was like, okay, we know. They didn't feel like they had to prove anything. They know they were good players, but they know also that they're good persons and people. They don't take it for granted that you're gonna treat people well. I don't take that for granted, but they did, and it made the whole group and the whole team feel comfortable.
When playing with Daniel and Henrik specifically, we talked about this and, you know, you're trying to remember what their legacy was and why they're going to the Hall of Fame on the first ballot. And there's a lot of different reasons why, but one of them was, and we pointed this out, is that there hasn't really been too many NHLers, maybe none ever, that fought the game at such an elite level that cerebrally they were that much ahead of the competition. It's almost like, you know, there's guys that are faster than everybody else. Maybe someone's got a harder shot than everybody else. Maybe someone's more physical than everyone else. But very rarely do you see two guys that outthink the opposition to the level that the Sedins did. When you had an opportunity to skate with them, how did you try and tailor your game or fit into what they were doing to match that sort of cerebral and intelligence level?
Yeah, no, you're right. I think that's a good comment. That was their game, outsmarting the opponents. I said it once or twice before. It was very rarely I was frustrated with them off the ice and not on the ice as well. It was when they passed, there was like Daniel to Henrik, Henrik to Daniel, and you were standing wide open and still didn't pass me. So that was the frustrating part, but. To your question, I think it's I think you're right on when you say like they really outsmarted the guys. They were not faster and not definitely not stronger like that, but they had the endurance and they weared people down with a grinding game in the offensive zone. So they always they usually scored late in their shifts with that, the outward guys like that.
We're speaking to a former Canuck, Mikhail Samuelson, now in the player development department here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650, talking about the Hall of Fame inductions, first ballot for Henrik Sedin, Daniel Sedin, and Roberto Luongo. Mikhail, what do you remember about Luongo during your time in Vancouver? Because we talked at length about the split career that he had. He spent a lot of time in Florida. He spent a lot of time in Vancouver. But the big difference between the two is the highs and the lows of his career, almost all of them happened exclusively in Vancouver. What was it like watching a goalie, which is a very isolated position in and of itself, watching a goalie like Roberto Luongo have to deal with all the highs and all the lows that he went through in Vancouver?
Yeah, that's a good question. First of all, when I think about Roberto, I think about the very professional guy. He was competing day in and day out. Did it always go his way? No, it didn't. But he always bounced back. And I think he had very, very high expectations, or people had for about him. And yeah, that created a very high expectations for himself as well. That's hard to handle, like see that, like anywhere in Canada, I should say, and especially Vancouver. And when we really had a good team there, it was ups and downs, but the most part I remember him as very, very, very much ups, and people only saw the ice on ice stuff. I got fortunate to see the off ice too, and he carried himself in a very professional way. He always try to do his best to help the team, and that's pretty much all you can ask for. And that he really cared. Yeah, he showed that day in and day out. So yeah, that's what I remember from Lou.
Did you ever feel for him that he felt so much pressure, and that there was so much pressure on him in this marketplace? I remember thinking at the time, you know, like, wow, being a professional athlete is so cool, and you get to have the fame and play in these big games, and you get paid a lot of money, and yet I would not want to be Roberto Luongo today, and that would be like on the day of the big game, because I can't imagine how nervous I'd be and how much I'd feel that and how much that would affect me.
Yeah, I know. At the same time, you signed up for this. I feel for you. Like, I know it's a lot of pressure on especially the goalies, but if you prepared like he did, I don't think you feel like really, really nervous. Obviously, I've never been a goalie, so I can't really look into those eyes. But yeah, I think he felt the pressure, but I think he was ready for it and up for it too. So really nervous. I don't think he looked at it that way. He looked at it like a challenge, and sometimes it goes his way, and sometimes it's not. But that's always the case. It's not going to go your way. You can't expect it to go your way all the time, but how do you bounce back from it? And that's the greatness of Lou. Like he really thought or tried to bounce back, and very often he did as well. So,
what about the Sedin seeing each other, seeing them compete with each other? Do you have any funny stories about that? Because they were talking about how when they were younger, And I really liked this story that they told. Like, they competed with each other in everything, and some days one would win, and other days the other would win, and you just sucked it up. And if you didn't win, and you went on to the next day and competed in that. I imagine that must have really helped them get to where they went. That they had someone, they had their self, they had their identical self to compete with every day. That's a good way to get better.
Right. It is like competing nowadays. Like competing is, underrated. That's and like you say, like if you have that your whole life, you don't know anything else than compete. But them as a person, like they were big around, like on the ice. The teammates saw them as leaders, but at the same time they were very low key. If they competed with each other, everybody didn't see that they did. They probably did. If they say they did, they did. So, but if they've competed, I remember we played like ping pong games in the locker room, or like I know they're big runners now. They're into that. And sometimes when I speak to them, like, oh, Henrik beat Daniel, next time Daniel beat Henrik. But they're not making a big deal out of it. They just, yeah, suck it up and, like they said, and keep moving on. So I don't think anybody really saw how much they were competing.
We're speaking to Mikhail Samuelsson here on the Halford and Bruff Show on Sportsnet 650. Mikhail, it was a big day yesterday for Swedish hockey with Daniel and Henrik going in. Also, Daniel Alfredsson finally gets the tap from the Hockey Hall of Fame. One guy that didn't yesterday, another one of your former teammates and fellow countrymen, Henrik Zetterberg. In your mind, is Henrik Zetterberg a future Hall of Famer?
Yes, he is. I was, I'm not going to lie, I was a little surprised he didn't get in. He's right up there too with the Sedins and Nalfi in that class, how he carried himself, and he meant a ton to that organization, to the Red Wings. So yeah, hopefully one day. He's right up there too with great teammates and great on the ice as well.
You must feel a lot of gratitude about the types of players that you've been able to play with throughout the years, the guys in Detroit, the guys in Vancouver. Yeah. There's a lot of Hall of Famers there. When you look back on your career, do you have that? Do you have that appreciation? You're like, wow, I played with some really great hockey players.
I you know what? Both yes and no. It's not like I'm walking around and thinking like, okay, I've been teammates with those. But when things like this come into mind, like with the Hall of Fame and like the Daniel and Henrik is there and Lou and let's talk about Zetterberg, that like it makes me proud too to be on the ice at the same time and actually maybe sometimes thinking the game the same way. That makes me proud. So and I'm happy for them. A lot of people are happy for them, but. Yes, on special occasions, yes, I feel like, okay, I did something too. Not take anything away from them, but that, yes, that can make me, that can make great, in my mind, great memories.
Well, you were a pretty good player too, Mikhail. I didn't mean to insinuate that. You were lucky to be there. You were a good player too, and the Canucks missed you on that latter half of the 2011 run, and I still think about that sometimes. Thanks again for joining us today, Mikhail.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Have a good one.
YouTube, thanks. That's Mikhail Samuelsson, former Vancouver Canuck, now a member of the team's player development department, and, of course, a former teammate of Daniel Sedin, Henrik Sedin, and Roberto Luongo. We've got a bunch that we can get into here from either around the National Hockey League. We can dive back into the Hockey Hall of Fame stuff. Where would you like to go, Jason? What would you like to talk about? We could do some audio yesterday. We alluded to it earlier, the Ryan Johnson interview with Donnie and Dolly, Check TV, the team, where he was talking about, among other things, JT Miller and where you are in your competitive window and whether you want to bring the same group back, you want to move forward. Thomas Drance, who's going to be joining us at 8 o'clock, wrote a really cool piece with Harmon Dial about what the ideal, perfect offseason would look like for the Vancouver Canucks. We can go in a variety of directions here.
I think we should play a bit of this Ryan Johnson interview. Rick Dhaliwal comes on our show once in a while, and he's always a great guest. So why not give the Donnie and Dolly show a little attention? Because they really did have a great interview with Ryan Johnson, who's still the general manager of the Abbotsford Canucks, but now he's got a new title. He's the assistant to the general manager, not the assistant general manager, the assistant to the general manager.
Big time Dwight Schrute vibes.
And so I think it was Donnie yesterday asked Ryan Johnson, what with this new promotion? Now you can answer questions like this. What's going on with JT Miller? And this, do we have it queued up? This is listen to this, because I think this tells you a lot about what the Canucks are thinking right now.
Well, at this point, you've got to look at all options. Right now, he's a Vancouver Canuck, and we prepare as if he is. But obviously, there's discussions being had that obviously now is the draft approaching, and you've always got to look at options to make yourself a better team in the short term and the long term. And that's a process Patrick is going through with all our players. And as we've seen and I've talked to you guys, but we need to push ourselves to get a little bit uncomfortable to get better. We want to get better. And sometimes, and this isn't in reference to JT Miller, but sometimes you got to make hard decisions as an organization to do that. When you idle or just kind of you keep coming back with the same group, you're not pushing yourself maybe necessarily to do that. That's the challenge we have in evaluating our whole group and making tough decisions on free agents or RFA guys that we have to do those things. And that's how you get better. And we got to push ourselves to do that.
One of the more difficult things as an executive in any sport, NHL or otherwise, is being able to look at your group objectively. And that means taking a step back and almost removing yourself from it. And it's funny, I was watching Moneyball the other day,
yep,
for like the 9,000th time. And there's a really good, and I don't know how accurate this is to what actually transpired in real life. But
was Billy Beane that good looking?
Yeah, he is handsome. He says specifically, I can't be close to the guys in the room. I don't want to develop a personal relationship with them. I don't want to know if they've just enrolled their kids in school or if they've got a baby on the way or if they're going to get married, because it will make it much more difficult to do my job, yeah, which in the end is cold and calculating and designed to be objective. I have to look at this as if I'm the general, and tying it back to I'm the general manager of the Vancouver Canucks, but I'm not a member of the Vancouver Canucks, if that makes sense.
Sure.
You're not the guy in the room.
You're not one of the guys in the room.
You're not going to battle with the boys. You're not in the wars. You're not getting yelled at Nathan MacKinnon for eating Alfredo sauce, right? You're not that guy. You're out from the outside looking in. What is
your obligation is to the team. Your obligation is to the betterment of the team in trying to win a championship. It's not to be a good guy to this guy,
so,
or to be overly loyal to this guy.
So in with relation to what Ryan Johnson said in the clip, the question is, can you take a step back and look at the group that's currently assembled and either say, one, yep, this is the group, this is the core, we believe in these guys 100% that they can get to a level where they can compete to a Stanley Cup. And if the answer to that question is no, then you have to look at it the other side. Is it time to move on? Do we bring the same group back? And if the answer is no, then you've got some really big decisions to make where you have to say, for example, JT Miller, you were fantastic last year. You were the heart and soul of this team. If we had to pick a most valuable player, you might have been it if it wasn't Thatcher Demko. But we can't bring you back because it makes more sense to move you out at this stage. And that's as cut and dry as it can be. If he would just say, well, why are you moving me? Because it makes more sense than keeping you. That would be it. And that was what I allude to with the Moneyball thing, is when they trade Carlos Peña. They go in and they're like, you know, they don't say all this stuff, but he was a rookie of the year candidate. He was their best prospect. And they just went in and they're like, we're trading you to the Tigers. Mm-hmm. Someone from the secretary's office will be in touch for the details. And that's it. And really, that's all it comes down to in the end.
For me, it's just about asset management.
But yeah, it's exactly it.
And with JT Miller, if you re-sign JT Miller, have you locked yourself into a diminishing asset? And don't get me wrong, there is tremendous risk in trading JT Miller. We talk a lot about the Colorado Avalanche and how they made some really defining trades. You think about the Matt Duchene trade that helped revamp their blue line. You think about the Tyson Barrie trade that brought them Nazem Kadri. For sure, those deals worked out. Here's the thing, not all the deals work out. They didn't get much of a return for Ryan O'Reilly, for example. Mm-hmm. But because they made those deals, because they made some tough decisions and traded some really good players away, now they're Stanley Cup champs. Now, there's a bunch of other stuff that went into that. But I really liked what Ryan Johnson had to say about being in idle. And that's, in some ways, if you bring back the same group, how do you get better? How do you get better long term? Guys, get better. You know, it's the same group, though.
Mm-hmm.
Or you got to shake it up sometimes. And Jim Rutherford has come on our show and said, well, sometimes, you know, you got to take a step back. And that's something, and this was months ago, he was like, that's something we are considering, whether or not we have to take a step back in order to take a step forward. And it doesn't make sense sometimes, or if you think about it in a vacuum, like, how do you get better trading away your best player? Well, it all comes down to asset management. It comes down to, you know, the value you get on a contract. JT Miller on his current contract and being at the age he was tremendous value. Mm-hmm. If you give him a significant raise and he gets into his 30s, then it might not be tremendous value. Now, the key part in all of this, of course, is if you are going to trade JT Miller, you better find a way to make that deal impactful. Because if you trade away JT Miller for some magic beans and they don't amount to anything, then you've made the team worse, mm-hmm. long term and short term. That's the risk. That's the complication. That's why it's hard to win the Stanley Cup. But the bar, again, is so high to win. We were just talking about a Canucks team that had 3 first ballot Hall of Famers and a Selke Trophy winner in Ryan Kessler. They couldn't win the Stanley Cup. Mm-hmm. How many first ballot Hall of Famers do you see on the Canucks right now? You'd say maybe 1 or 2.
Yeah,
if they all pan out.
That's a super tough projection.
Who knows? Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah. That's really tough. I get what you're saying.
But yeah, and plus, in addition to those first ballot Hall of Famers, you have to fill out the roster really well as well. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the Avs, they've got, you know, McKinnon, first ballot Hall of Fame, McCarr, first ballot Hall of Fame, the way things are going, and some other guys might get there as well. But their strength was those guys, in addition to really smart pickups like a Lekkonen, who scored the winning goal for them, like a Nichushkin, who was so good for them in the playoffs.
Darren Helm.
It takes so much more than just the core. You have to do almost everything right, and you can't afford to waste any value, and that's where the Canucks are at right now. They're trying to get to that point.
Yeah, and there are ways off, I would say, right now. But we are on the precipice now of a very potentially, I'm going to throw it potentially, transformative offseason, because when I came in this morning, it's funny, Laddie actually said to me, someone clipped this from Frank Saravalli, and it was essentially Frank saying how there's nothing going on right now, and it's awfully quiet around the league, which I kind of was taken by surprise, because you assume with the Stanley Cup now handed out and everyone being ready for business, you'd get more news at the early part of the week than really 2 news notes from around the NHL yesterday. And one was that Luke Richardson had been hired as the head coach of the Chicago Blackhawks, which we kind of already knew over the weekend. That story had been leaked. The other one was that Don Sweeney got an extension in Boston. Like, noteworthy stuff, but nothing huge. Do we have the clip? Because this is kind of funny. Like, I kind of want to play it because this is kind of where we're at right now, waiting and waiting and waiting for something to happen. And maybe it's not going to happen yet. We got it?
The real title of the clip is Not Too Much Happening Around the League, RN.
Let's hear it.
Which stands for right now.
At this moment, and this actually goes kind of league-wide, in fact, I don't think the Canucks are hot on anything. Like, I don't think anything is imminent. I truly believe that, you know, from the people I've talked to around the league, it's still rather quiet. I don't know why that is, given that we are, I don't know, 9 days or 10 days from the draft. We're only, you know, 15, 16 from the opening of free agency. You know, things are happening. You know, this is when the rubber meets the road. And I think the interesting thing about the Canucks and their offseason is it feels like they had spent a long time trying to get other things in order, you know, namely the hockey ops decisions that you saw that came out last week, that there was a lot of housekeeping to do before they could really set their sights on getting to where they wanted to. And to that point, there's also no real rush, right?
Here's a sense that I'm getting from around the league, hearing what's going on in other markets as it pertains to contracts and what have you, is that the guys that are hitting free agency right now are like, man, this is a bummer. The worst time I could have hit free agency was coming right out of a pandemic where it's still a flat cap and a bunch of teams don't have the space.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of guys are saying, oh, I heard what Gary Bettman had to say at this year's Stanley Cup final, where revenues are back on the rise. Teams are making money again. I want to hit free agency, not this summer, not next summer, but like Pierre-Luc Dubois wants is in 2024.
Right.
So the other guys that are in this mix, and the one to keep an eye on out of Calgary is Matthew Tkachuk, because there's a lot of talk that he might not say the quiet part out loud like Dubois did, but he might just string it along until he can hit free agency.
Kick the can down the road until the salary cap starts rising in a significant way again.
And if you want to talk about how it pertains to the Vancouver Canucks, look at the deal that Elias Pettersson signed, right? Where does it walk him up to? Free agency in 2 years' time now, having played the first year of that deal,
yeah,
where he's going to be able to score a contract. So
the Canucks need to keep all of that in mind, too, if their plan is really to build a Stanley Cup contender.
So what we're saying right now is it looks like it could be this really transformative offseason for a lot of teams. But you got to remember, no cap growth. All the teams that are dealing with cap issues have the exact same issues going into this season because there hasn't been any extra room on the ceiling. You're looking at it and you're saying, well, we're kind of still in a pinch. What are we going to do? Gaudreau going to free agency. I understand that Calgary's there, but he's looking at it and saying, maybe I do look around the league and see who the highest bidder is because I'm not hitting this at a great time. So I want to get my money and get it now because I don't have another shot at this. There's some really fascinating things going on, adding to the fact that, as Frank says, we're a handful of days out from this NHL entry draft that one guy wants us to talk about ad nauseum. And we don't have a lot going on. It's quiet. That to me is really interesting. Very rarely will I say, oh, a clip about nothing means something, but I think we just heard something that maybe suggests this won't be as busy as a time that we thought it might be.
There's a lot of teams out there that want to do stuff, and then they hear, like, how are we going to do that?
Yeah.
You know, they're like, and a lot of players that probably want things like a massive contract extension, and the teams are like, what are you, out of your mind? We're in a flat cap scenario here.
And one of those teams could be the Vancouver Canucks. I'm just putting it out there. Anyway, we got a lot more to get to on the program. We're going to dive back into the big news from yesterday. Hockey Hall of Fame, first ballot inductions for Henrik Sedin, Daniel Sedin, Roberto Luongo. We'll talk to Sean McIndoe from The Athletic, better known as Down Goes Brown. He is our hockey historian. He is our Hockey Hall of Fame guy. He's going to join us next on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.
Edler to Daniel Sedin. Henrik going to the net. Daniel centers. Henrik deeks. Scores! And they're all going to come off the bench to congratulate Henrik Sedin. 1,000 points in the NHL. He wanted to do it at home. And he's done it against the man from whom he receive the captaincy, and they have a quick embrace as Henrik Sedin ties the game at one.
And what a pretty goal. You're going to get your 1,000th point. Might as well make it a good one. And Henrik Sedin and the Vancouver Canucks on the rush. And you can see Henrik acknowledging the crowd.
You're listening to Halford and Brough. You're listening to the best of the day.
I say you the best.
Halford and Brough.
Prince Sokol. Now he gets into the attacking zone. Luongo desperately trying to get on the ice. The shot to the net. Jaguar makes the save. And here comes Roberto Luongo.
8:03 on a Tuesday. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Halford Brough, Sportsnet 650. Halford and Brough of the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today by visiting your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. We are in hour three of the program. That music means that Thomas Drance will be joining us in just a moment here. Thomas Drance, just one part of an action-packed hour three. This hour of Halford and Brough is brought to you by Campbell & Pound Real Estate Appraisers. Trust the expertise of Campbell & Pound. Visit them on the World Wide Web at campbell-pound.com today. To the phone lines we go. You read his writing in The Athletic. You hear him on the Canucks Hour right here on Sportsnet 650. It is Thomas Drance on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. What up, Drancer?
Good morning, boys.
How was your chat with one of the newest members of the Hockey Hall of Fame, Roberto Luongo? I read the piece in The Athletic. Very well done. How was talking to Lou in the glow, the aftermath of being inducted into the Hall of Fame?
Well, obviously, it was a big day. You know, quite relatively, I don't think he'd quite wrapped his head around it. You know, I think that makes sense. I mean, it's a crowning achievement on your career. You know, it meant a lot to him, but I think he was getting all the calls and his phone was blowing up and his family was emotional. And I think for him, you know, I don't know that he'd had time to really process it beyond, hey, it's great that I'm going in with a couple of my friends. Like, this will be a cool thing to do together. You know, I think it, when I, by the time I sort of caught him Monday afternoon, I think that's sort of where he still was in terms of, you know, the honor resonating emotionally for him. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, I kept it light. It's an interesting chat. You can go read the one-on-one, of course, at theathletic.com. And, you know, some good jokes, some stories about trolling the Twins by stopping their blocker high shots with the shaft of his stick in Canucks practices, and just sort of reflecting on his time in Vancouver, in Florida, you know, what it all meant. And I'm sure it'll hit with a little more force as November approaches.
You, perhaps more than anybody other, are uniquely qualified to answer this question. If he had to pick a hat to wear into the Hockey Hall of Fame induction ceremony, would it be a Florida Panthers hat or a Vancouver Canucks hat?
Yeah. I mean, of course, he doesn't have to make that choice. Let's all remember that this is, it's not like the Baseball Hall of Fame where you go into the hall, right, with, as a member of one franchise rather than another. I would think Florida, that's his home. That's the team that he works for and represents today. You know, I'd think those two things would govern. Of course, the Panthers have retired the number one. The Canucks have not. So, you know, I would imagine were he in the position where he had to make the choice, it would be Florida. But that doesn't diminish, I think, what Vancouver means to him, or the fact, and you know, this is really the important one, that there's a recognition for him that the pinnacle of his hockey playing career, his biggest moments, happened in Vancouver.
Do you see his number being retired in Vancouver? Because it's an interesting position the Canucks are in. Because if they put him in the Ring of Honor with the likes of Kirk McLean, then some people might see that as a slap in the face.
I mean, I think it would be. I think it would be, right? Here's the thing. Luongo is, you know, along with the Twins now, right? And I suppose Bure. I mean, he's one of four Hall of Fame caliber players who had their best years in Vancouver. I mean, there's only four of those guys. I don't know why you wouldn't sort of retire that. Like, I don't understand the argument against retiring it. The one that I've heard over the years is that it would be a slap in the face to Kirk McLean to do so, but, you know, I don't really see it that way just because it's not really about McLean. Like, what Luongo accomplished in Vancouver has very little to do with another goaltender. And, you know, people will say, well, you know, Kirk McLean got them the furthest they've ever been and stuff like that. And, you know, when you compare the almost automatic way that Luongo churned out elite seasons in Vancouver, it's just materially different than McLean's career. I mean, McLean had some absolute lights out seasons with the Canucks. 91, obviously had the playoff run in 94, but not that regular season. But there were a few high end seasons, but McLean was like most goaltenders, right? Where you have a great season, you have a sub-average season, right? You have a great season, you have a sub-average season, right? The nature of stopping pucks shot by the most lethal shooters in the league, you know, leads to vacillations, like wild variance in puck-stopping performance year over year, and sort of what made Luongo special. And in his generation, it was really only him and Henrik Lundqvist who did this, was just year after year, 919, 921, 918, 919, 921, right? Like, year after year, he did it. And he did it at the highest level that he ever did it in, you know, across seven or eight seasons in Vancouver. To me, that's worthy of retiring his number. He's the best goaltender in franchise history. You could make an argument that he's among the best players in franchise history. You know, that 07 season, I think you could easily say was one of the best individual seasons anyone's ever put together for the Vancouver Canucks. Of course, he was the Hart runner-up that year. You know, for me, it's open shut. They should hang number one. but you know, we'll see. I mean, we'll see if they do it now that he's no longer, you know, still on the books for the recapture penalty. I would think that they should do it. I would hope that they do it, and doing it next year in advance of the Hall of Fame celebration would seem to give, you know, the club an opportunity and people in Vancouver an opportunity to celebrate this Hall of Fame class where you've got three players going in. You know, it doesn't feel like too difficult a decision to me, gentlemen.
I want to discuss something with regards to Daniel and Henrik Sedin here. Something you and I have talked about. I mean, it's alluded to in the book as well about when they became frontline players. And if you look at the chronology of it, it's kind of crazy. Jason and I were talking about how the Canucks' competitive bona fide Stanley Cup window with the Sedins at their peak was relatively small. Like they only went to one Stanley Cup final. Part of that has to do with the fact that Henrik's best season, the one that he won MVP and was the Art Ross winner, he was 29 years old. I mean, he was far along in his career. And if you look at the last three Hart Trophy winners, McDavid, Matthews, and Draisaitl, they were all either 23 or 24. So we're talking about a pretty significant gap in terms of when you were at your peak. Now, part of this has to do with the fact that, and I don't know if a lot of people really understand this, and it's always one of the, I love talking to you about this because you brought it up on numerous occasions. Part of the Sedins' patience and understanding the room and their thing is that they had to sit behind the West Coast Express probably for too long. And if we were to do revisionist history on this, if Mark Crawford had seen what they were going to be, and if everyone understood just how good they were going to be, they probably would have been put in a position of prominence before the lockout or when they were in their early 20s, and who knows where their careers would have gone from there.
Yeah, I mean, I think revisionist history is one of my favorite subjects.
Love it.
You know, I feel like I have a degree in revisionist history. It's one of my favorite things to do. The thing about the Twins, those sort of early years, you know, and maybe not the first two or three, but by the time you get to 02, 03, 04, their ice time's way too low. Like, way too low, considering what they were doing at the time.
Like, 13.5 minutes a game.
And like, power play two time, right? And we know what they ended up doing on the power play and what they ended up being as, you know, as power play point producers and just geniuses at the 5-on-4 game state. And, you know, when you look through their production, right, I mean, they would be, like, 40-point guys. We don't have... You know, there's no easy way to do points per minute because it's pre-behind the net era. We don't know what the underlying numbers look like, but I bet they were good. Like, I bet they were good. I watched those teams. That team played a lot in the offensive end, especially with the Twins on the ice with, like, Klatt or, you know, whomever their line mate was that season. And, you know, Taylor Pyatt for a bit. And when you sort of look through... When you sort of look through the league, like, they were probably scoring at a second or first line rate, even though, you know, in this market anyway, people were still talking about them as, you know, guys who just weren't quite superstars. And, you know, there's definitely an argument to be made that they were, in some ways, they rode shotgun for probably a little bit too long, and they were probably ready to do more earlier, But that said, I do think going back and having that lockout year, I think that, you know, did change a lot. It changed a lot for the team, obviously, with Bertuzzi, you know, him missing sort of that season. I do think overall, in retrospect, if the Twins had been given more earlier, they probably would have been far more productive. And more than anything, you know, if they'd found a way to contribute on the power play earlier, right? You know, even if you think about, like, should they have tried five forwards? Should they have tried, or today, would they have tried five forwards? Like, would you have tried Brendan Morrison as the point man on that unit, considering how reliable he was defensively? Would you have gone four forwards and one defenseman, and you have something like Jovo, Bertuzzi, Naslund, and the Twins with you know, Daniel in the bumper? I think if they'd come into the league 10 years later, you certainly would have seen them score more, produce more, get more opportunity far earlier than they did. It just so happened that by the time they broke into the lineup in Vancouver, Bertuzzi and Naslund had sort of, they were on to something. And so they settled into sort of being middle six forwards for the first 4 or 5 years of their career. And I think there were, you know, clear signs, both in retrospect and at the time, that in fact they were probably ready for a lot more than they got, far earlier than they got it.
Drancer, I want to go back to your interview with Luongo, because the one thing about Luongo is that he really thinks a lot. Like, and sometimes I actually wonder if that hurt him a little bit during his hockey career. I mean, he had a Hall of Fame career, but you know how sometimes you look at players and you're like, that guy's not a thinker, and it kind of helps him out there.
Sure.
But I also find him, because he's a thinker, he's, and I've said this before, I think he's the most fascinating athlete to ever come through Vancouver. He spoke with you about his relationship with the city of Vancouver, and the question you asked was basically, there are some people that out there that say you have a complicated relationship with the city of Vancouver. What did you take? First of all, what was his answer, and what did you take from that?
Yeah, I mean, he basically said that he thought there were some situations he could have handled better, that if he'd understood the pressures of the market and was more mature in his approach to it the way he is now, that he might have enjoyed it more as a player. The intensity that is this market. And I think the irony is that it was really after Luongo's sort of time in the sun as the key piece of this team had, you know, gone by the wayside, and people were talking about trading him, and everyone was, you know, enamored with Corey Schneider. It was like in that moment that I think he figured it out and started to really enjoy it, right? It almost came later in his tenure, as opposed to if he'd been there in 2009, making fun of things and just sort of treating this market like it was, you know, maybe like an NFL market, right? Like where you could say ridiculous things and we'd just be like, yeah, Luongo, cool. I think there's a bit of an irony there, right? And I think he's aware of it. And I think he's processed it. And I think at the end of the day, I think he's got an uncanny understanding of what it means to be a star player in this market. And I don't know that he had that when he was at, you know, the apex of his powers and the most talked about athlete probably, you know, certainly since Bure, but maybe in the history of Vancouver sports. So I don't know that he got there when it might have mattered. And I do think that's something that he's hyper aware of and seems to regret a little bit, to be totally honest with you. But, you know, I just think the complicated nature is a little bit, I think it's a little bit oversold. Like, I don't know. I know that it was always the tip of the tongue. I mean, even, right, when they acquired Luongo and he had that huge season, it was simple, right? And then I guess he had the bathroom break in that first playoff run, right? And he wasn't paying attention when the first goal or the overtime winner that eliminated the Canucks. It was a 4-1 series. They were never going to beat that Anaheim Ducks team. Like, we all know that. But Luongo, the last goal, the goal that eliminated them wasn't ideal. And then the next season, of course, I don't know if you guys will remember this, but I was saying this on the Canucks Hour. I remembered his second season with the Canucks as being a disappointment. And you look back now, and he played 76 games and had a 917 save percentage. Like, that's not disappointing in any world, but you'll remember that was the season where the Canucks faded down the stretch. Now I think we would have known that it was like a PDO bender that they were on earlier in the year, and then in fact the team had no ability to score. But he had also the travel between Vancouver and Florida as his wife was going through a relatively complicated pregnancy for their first child, and there was a lot of criticism about that, right? The well, his family doesn't live here, and will he stay, and will he sign that contract? And you know, it all sort of amped up and it became amplified, became a big talking point. By the time he ends up scoring, being in the Olympics, though, I felt like fans were, by and large, I mean, there was always some criticism of like, can he win the big one? But that's normal hockey stuff. Everyone who hasn't won a cup gets those questions. We sort of remember it a little differently for Luongo because of how it played out in 2011 in game 6 and 7, but you know, I just sort of look at that and think about, you know, there was a confidence, I think, going into playoff series most years, because, you know, part of the analysis was always Vancouver might have the best goalie. Maybe this is the year that he puts it together. He was at that level. And so, you know, I just think that Luongo soaked up a ton of oxygen while he was here. He was just larger than life during his Canucks tenure, regarded that way. And, you know, social media was at the advent. And the other thing, gentlemen, that I think people don't recognize really is the culture around the conversation about this team in this market is legitimately different. Like, we talk about this team like we're an American market talking about an NBA or an NFL team. And that's pretty unique. You know, you go east of us in Canada, and you've got a different type, a politer type of hockey chatter, right? There's like a deference given to management and players that just doesn't really exist in Vancouver. Meanwhile, we've still got the Canadian intense focus on the team that you don't really have in any American market, even the original six ones, even the big American markets. And that creates this wholly unique hockey culture that surrounds talking about this team. And as that was sort of crystallizing into its more contemporary shape, Luongo was the biggest story on this team for 5-6 years. And I think in the hockey world, people misinterpret that and see it as a complicated relationship, right? And for me, it's more just that, you know, Luongo was the biggest star in the most intense market for a team that was exceptionally good for a long time. And the volume around that naturally got turned up. I think we've made too much out of the complicated thing. The fact is that Luongo had a complicated tenure here, but I don't know that his relationship with the market is as complicated as people have framed it over the years.
What do you think he could teach to the young guys on the Canucks?
What do I think he could teach the young guys on the Canucks? I mean, a ton. I worked with Luongo when he was still a player. I haven't seen how he operates as an executive, not up close anyway. But I know that he's deeply involved on the goaltending side. I know he's around a fair bit in terms of traveling with the team, even in terms of being there day to day. You know, I'm sure he could teach them a thing or two at the card table. I think Luongo at his best was one of those guys who kept it pretty light in terms of how he carried himself off the ice, but on the ice was just ridiculous in terms of his work ethic, right? I mean, we'd fly into New York or what have you, and the team would go stay in Manhattan and he'd stay in Newark to be close enough to get ice like the next day, right? Like, he was just always on the ice. Every day he was on the ice, and he was like this when I was working with him. He was 36, 37, 38. Like, he was an older player, definitely older player, and he was still skating every day. And, you know, by that last season, skating every day meant 2 hours of warm-up exercises just to get his hips activated before he could step on the ice. And those weren't normal work. You know, it wasn't like a normal massage, right? It was like a painful RMT massage to get himself to a point where he could skate. And he did that every day. Like, he did that, you know, you play the night before, he's on the ice the next day. It was wild to see. And you contrast that with being sort of, like, by the time he was later in his career, like, the coolest guy, but, you know, the most accomplished guy, like, who was always kind of keeping it light and being funny and grinding his teammates, you know, and checking sports scores. And I think that's a pretty powerful team-focused player, particularly when you're a goalie, right? I mean, the unmatched work ethic combined with a guy who's seen it all and doesn't, you know, get too high or low and makes people laugh and lightens the mood. You know, I think that was sort of Luongo's genius in terms of being, you know, a goalie who wasn't as apart from the team as some goalies can be.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And that was sort of the way Luongo carried himself. So what could he teach the young guys on this team? I mean, you know, I think there's a lot, because when you look at this to turn the focus back to the current Canucks, you know, at the end of the day, we can make all the comments we want about team building and cap space and roster construction and upgrading the blue line. They really need to do that. They do. But this team's never going anywhere if Elias Pettersson's not the absolute best version of himself, right? If Quinn Hughes isn't the absolute best version of himself. And I think we've seen some of these players level up over the years, but there's still another level to get to together in terms of taking ownership for the situation, right? Beginning to understand that it doesn't matter who walked out the door in free agency or what's going on around the team or who the coach is. Like, it's on you, fundamentally. And I think there's a level of accountability that was natural for Luongo, natural for the Sedin twins, that I think this next group needs to really begin to adopt and embrace if they're going to take that next step as a team.
Drancer, you're the best, bud. Thanks a lot for doing this today. We really appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of the week. We'll talk again next Tuesday.
Cheers, boys. Be well. Bye.
You're listening to Halford and Brough.